Hey everyone, welcome to the Amateur Gourmet Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Roberts, the Amateur Gourmet, and today we have a fantastic episode for you. In fact, I might even venture to say this is the best episode I've ever created of this podcast. We have a Julia Child-themed episode with two extraordinary guests. We have the creator of the show Julia on HBO Max, which I just literally devoured in a couple of days. It's my new favorite show on TV. If you know Julia Child as a fan of her work or her TV show, you need to watch this show. And I get to ask Daniel Goldfarb, the creator of it, all about it. But first, I invited on Dori Greenspan, who is one of my all-time favorite cookbook authors and just personalities. She wrote Baking with Dori, Everyday Dori, Baking Chez Moi, and she's also the author of the XOXO Dori newsletter. And she actually knew Julia Child in real life because they worked together on the Baking with Julia cookbook. So to start off this episode, I thought I would ask Dori on to talk all about her experiences working with Julia. So here we go. Here's my talk with Dori Greenspan about Julia Child. All right. Well, we are here now with Dori Greenspan, who's one of my favorite people in the food world. And I'm so lucky that she agreed to talk to me today. Hi, Dori. How are you?
I'm the lucky one. Hi, Adam.
Hi. Well, I wanted to talk to you, A, because I've wanted to talk to you forever. And I hope you'll come back and let me talk to you again about your books and your work. But today we're doing a Julia Child themed episode.
Right.
And you, we're lucky enough to have worked with her. And I'm just curious, with all the attention that's now back on Julia, what's it like for you to have her thrust back in the limelight like this?
I'm so happy. I'm just a little sad because I think she would have gotten such joy out of seeing the appreciate. I think she knew how much people appreciated her, how much they loved her. But she never took anything for granted. She worked so hard at everything. She made it look like it was nothing, like it was just, you know, she could do it eyes closed, that it was effortless. But she worked really, really hard. And I think it would just make her so happy to know that this work lives on and that people still appreciate her. People are still learning from her. That would have been really important to her. The people
that's great.
Yeah.
And have you been watching the show, Julia?
So I've been watching, I only have the last two episodes to watch. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been watching.
And how does it, because when you just said that she worked so hard, I feel like the show does a good job of capturing that because you just see her not just machinating like to get the show on the air, but just how much work she put into each recipe. So does that feel right to you?
I was so happy when I saw that, that you come to understand how important this work was for her, how seriously she took it. So I worked with Julia in, oh, it's so long ago now, we worked together the summer of 1995 on the Baking with Julia PBS series and the book that I wrote. And when the book was written and out in the world, Julia was doing some touring for it. And she would call me every night. And the first thing she would say is, every recipe worked. For her, that was the most important thing. Mm-hmm. And you see, you can see that in the Julia show, just how she wanted everything to work right. She tested to get things right. Yes, that's an important part. And I think the show does a great job of showing that.
Well, I'm curious for you because I know obviously you're a Francophile who isn't just a Francophile. You're actually a resident or you live
part-timer. Yeah.
Part-time resident. But I'm curious in terms of Julia's love for France and your own love for France. And I'm not even sure where you grew up, but how much did Julia's love for French cooking impact your own love for French cooking?
So I grew up in Brooklyn.
Okay.
I say Brooklyn before it was hip and groovy. and in fact, I didn't grow up with Julia. So I hear so many people say, oh, you know, she was in the background. Well, you know, I'd come home and my parents would be watching Julia, or people who, you know, would have been of age to watch Julia. That wasn't me. So when I met Julia, which was in 1991, I had Mastering the Art of French Cooking, both volumes. Michael had made the baguette recipe, which runs like 17 pages. Mm-hmm. I had only cooked a few things from her books. And so I met Julia when my first book came out, and we connected over food and came to have wonderful conversations about France afterward.
Hmm. But so you had your own journey into French cuisine from Brooklyn, but did it, I guess I'm curious, like, did it mirror Julia's journey in the sense of, like, did you go there and eat sole meunier or however you say that?
You know, it's so funny. I did have that life-changing food experience, but I never thought about the fact that, yes, Julia and I had similar experiences. So while hers was the sole meunier, mine was a strawberry torte. Mm. I had it on our very, very first trip to Paris. It was, we were traveling on, like, you know, $5 a day for each of us. And that strawberry torte kind of broke the budget. And my husband, Michael, and I shared it. It was the size, it was about as long as my thumb. And it was a little barquette, so a little boat-shaped tort. And it had three tiny little strawberries on it, teensy tiny, fraise de bois. And Michael allowed me to have two of them, which is, this is why I love him and love him still. But I tasted that and I had kind of, I hadn't thought about it, but a Julia moment in that I felt like I was tasting butter for the first time. I was tasting vanilla for the first time and realizing that strawberries had a flavor that I had never had before. So yeah, we did have a similar French food experience.
I love that. It feels like it was part of this, like, awakening for Americans in a way to, like, go to Europe and experience the sensuality and just sort of have this breakthrough thing that then came back to the country. And in both your work and Julia's work showed people how to enjoy stuff like that. So that makes a lot of sense. I'm curious though, in terms of your very first meeting with Julia, and maybe you've told this story, but for people who don't know it, can you talk about the very first time that you met her?
I've told this story and I love telling it because I think that it's so Julia and it's also wild, crazy, and wonderful. So it's 1991. I had just written my first book, Sweet Times. And through a friend, I was invited to Boston University, where Julia Child and Jacques Pepin had started a gastronomy program. And I was invited to do a demo from my book of a recipe, and there were other people who were making their food. And I was petrified. I was the kid who, like, was afraid to get up in front of people. I didn't. But you have a book is like your baby. You have to take it out into the world. And so I said, yes. And I got there, and there was Julia, and there was Jacques, and I had to do my demo in front of them.
Oh, my God.
I just told you, I had this, like, lovely, it's just, I just looked up and saw Julia's face on the spine of Baking with Julia. Yes, Julia, I was really scared. And so I did the simplest recipe I could. All I had to do was put the ingredients in a food processor and press it. It was boring, but and press the button, and then out came this cake. And when I finished, Julia said, there's a dinner for all of the presenters, and I would like you to sit with me at this dinner. And, you know, she's like 6 feet, 5'4", and she put her arm around me and she said, come, we're going to have dinner together. And we were at, I know that there must have been other people at this table. It was a table for four people. I don't know who they were. I'm just looking at Julia. And at some point she says, well, you know that Saturday Night Live, that Dan Aykroyd imitation of me? And I had never seen it. I knew about it. All of America knew about it. So I said, I haven't seen it. She said, I'll show you how it goes. And Julia just lifted herself up. And there she was, all 6 feet of her, doing the Dan Aykroyd imitation with the chicken and the blood, and it finishes with save the liver. And it was extraordinary. I mean, Julia doing Dan Aykroyd, doing Julia. And That's how I met Julia.
That's so funny. Well, I mean, one thing that the show seems to really capture about her, and I'm curious if you could talk about this, is that as much as people think of her reverently or almost as sort of like this patron saint of gastronomy, I mean, she was sort of bawdy and, you know, like really like sex and really like drinking and really, you know, like there was like this other side to her that maybe people didn't know about. And I'm curious, did you get to experience any of that side of her when you worked with her?
She was so much fun. She loved to have fun. She would often, in postcards and things that she would write, she would use the word jolly, and mm-hmm. which is a word we never use any longer, but I think I can hear her saying it. She loved a good time, and she could kind of mix stuff up to kind of like get things going. We would have at the end of, you know, the end of it, shooting an episode, sometimes we would all stay together in the kitchen and cook, and it was always fun. She wanted to laugh, and she wanted other people to laugh, and she wanted them to enjoy food as they were making it. And yeah, she had this kind of little mischievous, mm-hmm. mischievousness to her. and it was always, so my husband claims that he learned to be a better hugger because of Julia. She was incredibly affectionate. She was warm. She was wildly curious about everything. And yeah, she would say unexpected things, and you'd look at her and think, she did that on purpose. She knew she was going to get us with that. And she had perfect comedic timing. I mean, just perfect.
And in terms of, I mean, this is all so positive and wonderful. I mean, was there anything frustrating about working with her? Or were there moments where maybe you tried to show her something that you've made and where she disapproved of something? I mean, was there ever any moment like that?
No, it's really funny because while I was in Cambridge, we were working on the show. There was a story, a reporter was doing a story on Julia. And I don't know why she called me, but she said, everybody has such good things to say about Julia. My editor won't run this story unless I can get a contrary opinion. Who shall I call to say something? I can't think of anyone. So no, if anything, I'm trying to think. So one day she called me. And this was before when we were planning the show and the book. And I'm in New York and she's in Cambridge. And she calls and she says, do you ever use a bread machine? And I said, no. She said, you sound like you're not interested. I said, I'm not. I said, a bread machine doesn't interest me at all. She said, that's the wrong attitude. Mm. She said, you've never used it. You don't know what it can do. I sound so scolding. She wasn't scolding. She was a little scolding. Not scolding. I think she was disappointed in me. Like, where was my mm-hmm. sense of adventure and curiosity? And she said, I'm getting a bread machine today, and I think you should too. And in the end, we had a bread machine in the show and in the book. So she was very easy.
And in terms of like her cooking, like when you would go over, because did you work in her home when you were working with her, or was it mostly in a studio?
Well, her home was the studio.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So, yeah, okay. So for Baking with Julia, she had, you know, you see it in, just seeing the kitchen on the Julia show. She had this beautiful wooden table, and that was taken out, and a big counter was built. And that's where, so everything happened in her in her kitchen. And we would cook the lunches were all brought in, and every caterer, we went through many caterers. Every caterer was told, whatever you do, don't serve a pasta salad. And I don't know why people didn't listen, but they served a pasta salad, and then we got a new caterer.
What did she have against pasta salad? Just because she didn't like cold pasta?
I don't know. I might be exaggerating just a little, but pasta is on the no list. Yeah, and then we wouldn't often cook at night because everything was set up. But a lot of times, you know, the chef from work that afternoon would stay over, and we'd make a big meal for everyone, and everybody would just be in the kitchen doing something.
And how old was she when you were working with her? Was she sort of, I mean, the 90s, right? I mean, was she sort of in her 70s?
No, I think she was older. Can we do the math? Can you look up like when she was born? I think she was in her 80s.
Julia Child born. Let's see. I could do this. I'm very good. 1912. So yeah, 1912. So she would have been in her 80s. Yeah.
95. Yeah. And she hard to keep up with.
Interesting. Because I was going to ask you, because I watch a lot of her old shows. And one of the things I think that Julia, the show gets right about her from what I've watched on her show, is her breathing. It almost feels like she had labored breathing, or maybe not labored breathing, but there's something about her, like she sounds sometimes winded, but maybe because she's doing so much. But I was curious.
Breathy, I would say. It was kind
breathy,
of
breathy, yeah.
Some people say warbly, but I'm not speaking as Dr. Dory now, but I don't think it was medical. I think that was her voice, because she had plenty of energy.
Wow.
I worked in the Red Room, and it was named the Red Room because it had Paul Child paintings, all of which had red in them. And that's where I had my camera, my screen set up, and it was also where Julia got her hair and makeup done. So I'd come in at 7 a.m. and Julia would already be there. She'd have the news on the television. She'd have the Boston Globe and the New York Times, and she'd be looking. She was so interested in what was going on in the world. And, you know, we could have been out to dinner until midnight, but she was, you know, up there, brave, ready to go.
Well, I think it's almost the secret to longevity is to be enthusiastic about whatever you're doing. I mean, even when you talked about the bread machine, that she, you know, in her 80s, she was excited about this bread machine. You know, it's like, I think to have that enthusiasm keeps you going and keeps you healthy.
She was extraordinary in what interested her, and people interested her. So whenever you talked to Julia, she looked directly at you. For doing a book signing with her, somebody, you know, the line would be endless. And she would take time with each person, and she would look at each person. She'd never like look down the line to see what was happening, or look over your shoulder to see if there was some important person there. She was interested in you. And I've never heard an interview with Julia where she didn't ask the interviewer a question with genuine interest.
I love that. Yep. And that's such a great quality. Well, as a final question, is there a dish that you still mostly associate with her, like when you cook it or when you eat it?
Tuna salad.
Okay.
So Julia's working lunch, and it was the first meal that I had at her house when we first came up to start talking about the project, was a tuna salad sandwich. This is what she made. If you know, it was lunchtime, you're working, and she didn't make it. She could make it, but she always got everyone involved. So that first day, she turned to me and said, "Dory, I'm the only person in the world who doesn't do a Julia accent." And can I just tell you a little side story for a second? I was once at a conference with Julia. I think it was in IACP conference, International Association of Culinary Professionals. And Julia and I are sitting side by side, and someone's up on the podium. I can't remember whom. And they start talking like Julia. And Julia turned to me and said, "I don't sound like that, do I?" And you know, that split second moment, I wanted to say, "Julia, no," because I knew that. But I said, "Yeah, actually you do."
Well, how did she handle that?
I'm sure this wasn't the first time. And I'm not even sure that she didn't ask me just to put me on. just to be her adorable self. She said, "Dory, you do the celery." And of course, I wanted the celery to be perfect because it was for Julia. She had the whole thing done, and I'm still like making little celery squares. But she'd have a tuna sandwich on a English muffin or on bread. And so every time I make tuna sandwich, I think about my first meal with Julia. Not the strawberry tart, but just a tuna salad sandwich.
And is there anything specific about what went in the tuna for Julia? That was just mayo and salt, pepper, and all that stuff?
And onions. She liked onions. But it's just the idea that was our first meal. And that was also, you know, so Julia, she could take pleasure in beautifully complex, sophisticated meals. And, you know, she loved an In-N-Out burger and she liked a tuna salad sandwich. And, you know, that's, she loved food. She loved the people who made food and she loved sharing it.
Well, Dory, this was such a delight. I'm so glad that I asked you to talk about Julia, and I hope you'll come back and let me ask you all about yourself and Brooklyn and baking and France. I feel like we could talk for hours.
Thank you. I'm always happy to talk to you.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dory. Have a great rest of your day.
You too.
Isn't Dory Greenspan the coolest? I'm obsessed with her. And if you're obsessed like I'm obsessed, be sure to subscribe to her newsletter, XOXO Dory, which you can find just by Googling it. I get it every week in my inbox, and it always brings a smile to my face. And now for our main event, we are going to talk to the creator of the TV show Julia, Daniel Goldfarb. I first became aware of Daniel when I was a student in NYU's Graduate School for Dramatic Writing. I actually studied playwriting there, and I never got to take a class with Daniel, but he was already a superstar there. Since then, he's gone on to write for Mrs. Maisel. He wrote the Martin Short show, Fame Becomes Me, which I saw on Broadway and absolutely loved. And now he's got the biggest feather in his cap, which is Julia, which just got a second season. When you hear us talk, it hadn't happened yet, but since we recorded this interview, it got announced that there's going to be a second season. So, without further ado, here is my talk with Daniel Goldfarb. All right. Well, Daniel, thank you so much for coming on my podcast. I've been binging Julia, and I absolutely love it. So, first of all, congratulations on it. Are you enjoying the success?
Yes. It's been thrilling. Really, it's been a long, it was like a four-year journey. We had lots of hiccups along the way. So to finally share it with people, and the response has been so great. It's been really very gratifying. So thank you.
Oh, yeah. I mean, for me, it's funny because I've been writing about food for 20 years. And when I first heard, without even seeing anything about it, that there was going to be a Julia show, I was like, oh, I wonder what that's going to be like. And I didn't expect to love it as much as I do, just because I thought I knew the story. But it's so much like, there's so much nuance to it, and just the performances are so lovely. It just, the whole thing just feels lovely. It's just like a delight to watch. All right, I'm just like praising you to death. But there's so much craft that goes into it, and we have a mutual friend, James, who maybe told you that I went to the dramatic writing program where you teach. But then
I also went as a student.
And you went in as a student. You know, James was in my class, and the fact that he's a teacher there now is like mind blowing. But anyway, like talking to you is like going to like scratch two itches for me, because one, I'm so curious about the food, but I'm also curious about the structure and the creation of the show and how you came up with it. So maybe we can start with just the initial idea for it and how you came up with that.
So, you know, it wasn't my idea. There's a woman named Kimberly Carver, who's a manager at 3Arts, and she is friends with Todd Shulkin, who runs the Julia Child Foundation. And they had lunch and they cooked up the idea of doing a show about Julia. And they were reading and then meeting with writers. And I was working on The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
Uh-huh.
So, which I feel like that pedigree kind of got me even in the running to be considered. And I had written a pilot for Showtime called Genesis about like a mature marriage, very much about a marriage. And so my manager had submitted Genesis and had said that I'm a big foodie. And the first, you know, the play I wrote in grad school was like a fictional play about Ruth Reichel and John Simon going on a date. And the first pilot I ever sold was about like a fictional version of Ruth Reichel, a restaurant critic who reviews restaurants in disguise. So I've been wanting to do something.
Oh my gosh.
My whole career. And I had coffee with Kimberly. We did like every January, we would do a Maisel field trip because my bosses, Amy and Dan, had award shows every weekend. So instead of them flying back and forth, they just brought the whole writer's room to LA for 3 weeks every year.
Nice.
And I was there and I said, this is how I see it. And this is my take on it. And thank goodness she decided to go with me. So that's how I got the job. Yeah. And then Chris Kaiser, who's my partner in this, she asked me to pair up with a more experienced showrunner. I had worked for Chris on Tyrant, and he's just a really great man. He's a really generous, good, menschy person. And he's really smart and he's really funny and he loves the theater. And I really trust him. Mm-hmm. And so I took him out for dinner and I said, this is my take. And are you interested and want to do this with me and develop it with me? And luckily he said yes. And then we went from there.
So what was, if you had to articulate like what your take was on Julia that helped you sell it? I mean, when you brought up the pilot that you wrote about the mature marriage, it feels like the marriage part of it was an important part of it for you.
Yes. So thematically, we always talked about it as like the invention of the modern marriage, that we start, the season starts in a happy, loving, good marriage, but a like 1950s idea of a marriage. Mm-hmm. And, you know, where Julia does things behind her husband's back and has to get him on board. And then by the end of the season, it becomes a true partnership and a real mm-hmm. marriage. So that was always part of the architecture. That was part of the pitch. That's what I was talking about with Kimberly. And then in like a sort of show busy Hollywood, like shorthand, I was like, it's The Crown meets Mrs. Maisel. <You know? laughs> And then we talked about it's Julia's second act and the invention of food television. And also all these cultural changes taking place in the United States in the 60s.
Well, it's so interesting, like the idea of the mature marriage, because there's so much, like there's really like nuance. I mean, I'm gay in my, I'm just gay, but there's an, I don't know how I said it that so weirdly, but I have that episode with James Beard, and like, there's so much that goes on in that episode that it was fascinating to me. Specifically, like, I think that's the same episode where Julia goes to Smith College to her reunion.
No, that's the previous episode.
Oh, that's the previous episode. It's still like in terms of like
episode four, and then in episode five, yeah. They go to San Francisco. So, you know, we kind of divided the season into three acts in a way.
Yeah.
So the first three episodes are like getting started. So, it starts with her making that omelet and I've been reading. And episode three ends with her saying, welcome to the French Chef. And it's the first real episode of the show. Mm-hmm. So it's just like the beginning. And then the middle is sort of the growing pain. So then we do like a time cut. It's about her sort of coming to terms with becoming a public figure. And in episode four, she's not sure she likes it. And in episode five, she realizes that she does like it. Mm-hmm. And then in episode six, she really like Julia as CEO, she sort of is more confident, is calling the shots. And then the last two episodes are about like what it means, like what mm-hmm. the French Chef means to different people and how Julia is sort of confronted with that and has to sort of work through that. So we always thought of it as like these three separate chapters, which is why we aired the first three all on premiere night. There was discussion made about just doing the first two. And then we were like, well, the first three is the first chapter. And then there's this jump. So why don't we, if we're going to do more than one, why don't we do the first three? And then episode four, the following Thursday, but we're, you know, 2.5 months later and things that.
Got it. Well, it's almost like a superhero origin story in a way. It's like you're seeing her become like Batman, or you're seeing her, but she's becoming this like icon that we all know and love as this almost like mythical figure. And you're seeing that process. I'm curious though, and I'm sure you must get asked this all the time about the casting, because is it Sarah Lancashire? Is that how you say her name?
Yeah.
I mean, she is so splendiferous in that role and just brings so much subtlety and just like her eyes watering up or just like her facial expression. So how did you land on her, and was that a difficult process?
So, I mean, there was a list that was generated and just kind of everyone's eyes gravitated towards her. It's a tricky part. It's a great part, mm-hmm. but you know, Meryl Streep played it in a movie. There's so much footage of her. She's 6'2". There's all these
things
that make it kind of complicated. And she has a funny voice, but you know, unlike in the movie, it's not split with another story. It's sort of all Julia all the time. And we had to just sort of navigate that and figure that out. And everyone felt we were all just big Happy Valley and Last Tango and Halifax fans. And this is like mm-hmm. me and Chris, but also the people at Lionsgate, the people at 3 Arts, the people at HBO Max, Linda Lowy, the head of casting there. Like everyone sort of felt like she's one of the greats. She has authority. She has warmth. She has intelligence. She has these giant eyes, as you mentioned, and express kind of multiple conflicting thoughts simultaneously. And then when we went online, like she's done musicals on the West End. And she...
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah. And she has like comedy chops. And we were like, and she has a flair for the theatrical. And Julia is theatrical. Like if you read Julia's letters to Avis or Julia and Paul, they were just very witty and they loved language. So as a playwright, it was really fun for all of us in the writer's room to kind of lean into that. So we need our whole cast. They're almost all theater actors, or they all.
Oh, yeah. Like David Hyde Pierce.
David and Baby Newark. And
yeah. Amazing.
Have amazing theater credits. And so they could sort of like luxuriate in the language of the childs and the wit of that time. And so anyway, so we just, and then we sent her the script, and according to Sarah, she didn't even know it was about Julia Child until she was like 10 pages in. It was called Julia, and she didn't grow up with Julia Child. She only knows Julia from the movie.
Okay. She's from England?
She's from the UK.
Okay.
And she's not very well known there. And just thank goodness she responded to the material and she said, yeah.
Well, what's in terms of the writing, I mean, I was going to ask you about this because, I mean, when I was in writing school, we were always talking about like, what are the stakes? Like, what are the stakes of the story? Like, why should we care? And I feel like very early on in the story, the stakes are established. Like, and somehow I feel like it's connected to her not having children, or there's that scene. I think that's in the first episode where she finds out she's going through menopause. And I'm just curious, in terms of constructing this, how you thought about making the audience get invested in the story and creating it as a stakes-full story, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no. So what was interesting about it is, on the one hand, it's a low-stakes story, and we wanted it. And it's a human, not low stakes, but it's human scale stakes. And in this sort of era of like binge television, where the like wild cliffhangers at the end of each episode that are always sort of exciting, but sometimes not, I don't know, believable necessarily.
Yeah.
You know, we really love the intimacy of the story, and we wanted it to be an intimate story. At the same time, we wanted it to drive, and something that I feel now that I've worked in television for 10 years is like a great way to drive a television series is to give your protagonist a secret. So we gave Julia the secret that it was her idea, not WGBH's, and that she has to convince, and then Paul doesn't think it's a good idea. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when we did the research, you know, she did go on I've Been Reading and at the last minute bring a hot plate, you know, because she on a whim, and they did get 27 letters, and she did write a long letter to GBH proposing the idea of a show. What we made up is that Paul didn't know that she did it behind Paul's back.
Got it. Okay.
That said, we know that Paul was upset when he was asked to retire. He didn't do it. It wasn't his notion. It was something that came from the government. We know that Paul was a little bit of a snob about television, and that the Childs didn't own a television until The French Chef went on the air. So it felt truthful in the research, even though there's nothing in the research that says Julia did it behind Paul's back. When we sort of like read between the lines and connected the dots, it felt really true to the story. And
it makes the audience feel part of it too. Like we're in on the secret with her, and we're like watching her pull, you know, machinate.
And
again, that's really fun.
It's not this sort of like, it's not a doll's house. She's not in a bad marriage where she has a secret from her husband. She loves her husband, and the secret is killing her inside, and she doesn't want to have a secret. So that felt like that would be enough actually to drive the season. So that was sort of something that we thought of early on. That would be, that felt, again, we always said we were doing like the Amadeus version of Julia Child. So Peter Schaffer, when he wrote the great play Amadeus, said, I did a lot of research, and even though the research doesn't say this is the story, I stand by it. It maybe isn't what happened, but maybe it is what happened. It definitely is what could have happened. And just because the history wasn't documented that way doesn't mean it didn't happen that way. So
when you were in the writer's room working on this, was there somebody there like holding like her biography, like,
no,
did you guys just throw it out the window?
Well, I mean, we had a researcher, which was invaluable, and we had a really wonderful group of writers, and everyone read, I mean, there's a lot out there about Julia. There's numerous biographies. There's all of her talk show appearances. There's all the French Chef episodes. There's all the magazine article she did. So there's a lot you can find. And Julia also contradicted herself a lot. So there's like, she says one thing in one magazine, but then she says the total opposite thing in another magazine. And the contradictions are part of what makes her so interesting. So again, like in terms of the reading between the lines, people have written a little bit about the child's homophobia, and that was part of who they were.
Interesting. Okay.
But at the same time, Julia's dearest friend was James Beard.
Right.
Yeah, and that was really interesting to us. And San Francisco was the first city outside of Boston to start airing The French Chef. And the research also showed us that almost as soon as The French Chef started airing in San Francisco, drag artists were doing Julia Child in underground like drag bars.
You know, my favorite scene in the whole show is the one, and it's such a throw. It's just like a tiny little moment. I'm sure maybe you know what I'm going to say, but it's where the drag Julia Child goes home and tells his mother that he met Julia, and she can't believe it. And it's just like such a sweet little moment because it's not part of the larger story necessarily.
Yeah, that's so. Yeah. You know, we fought for that moment because it's like one of the only times where we break POV and go with
Julia.
Yeah. And then in the next scene, you know, she calls him a queen and he calls them fairies. And again, it's the contradiction. So that was, so again, what in the research, we knew Julia drag performers existed. We knew about James Beard, but we also knew about her conflicting thoughts about gayness. And we thought, well, what if James, so we don't, the one thing we don't have proof of is that James Beard took her to one of those clubs.
Right.
But again, all the research added up that it could have happened.
And what about the Smith College moment where her old friend is sort of saying there was a thunderstorm and they like were...
Yeah, again, that was something like there have been different things written about the Childs, about both of them in terms of sexuality that you can find.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, not to be totally reductive, but it is Smith College. she was on the basketball team. And, you know, and Pia was a virgin until she met Paul. You know, she lost her virginity in her mid-30s. So she was still and sort of came to, it's not like she had a rich like history of boyfriends and dating life in her 20s. And
I think part of the reason I awkwardly brought up my sexuality is because I wanted to bring that up because I don't know if I was reading into the show when I was watching it, but there was a combination of like that Smith College moment and then the like James Beard thing, and where I was sort of maybe intimating that maybe there's an implication that Julia and Paul could have both been gay and that they found each other and were sort of, they still loved each other, or that they, but then they also have a lot of sex with each other.
And they have with each other. And they literally like, they sent Valentine's Day cards of the two of them in the bath naked.
I've seen it. Yeah. I've seen that on someone's refrigerator.
It is one of the great love stories. And that is part of what's so fascinating about them. Again, like all of those contradictions. Like, I mean, if you look at photos of Paul, he looks exactly like David Hyde Pierce, and the kind of colorful clothing that Paul wears in the show is exactly like those are all, that's all taken from photos. That's really very much the true style of Paul. So it's all, we don't want to comment on it too much. We just want to show it all.
And I think it's reductive to be like, are they gay? Are they not
gay?
Right. It's like, overly simple. It's like, no, it's they're adults with complexity. The other theme that I really picked up on this show, and I'm curious to hear you talk about it, is the idea, and I really relate to this because I gave up a career or aspiring career as a playwright to become a food writer. And in the show, that's a real conflict in the show for the producer, for Russ, and for Judith Jones, this idea that like food isn't as serious as... literature, as theater. And with your background as a playwright, I'm curious, did that theme emerge, you think, from yourself, or was that something that was intrinsic to the story?
No, I think that was something that was more intrinsic to the story. I've never thought of food as lesser. Like, I worship food people. When we had our premiere, we Cherry Bomb, they hosted this dinner and I got to meet like Claudia Fleming and Deb Perelman.
Wow.
And I was like flipping out. I'm totally starstruck by food.
Deb Perelman is my old friend because we were food bloggers together back in New York.
Amazing. It was really exciting. So, but I think that really just comes out of the time. Like in the research, you know, Russ did study to be a director and he was supposed to be the assistant director of Endgame at the Cherry Lane. And he took the job at GBH instead. And he loved British documentaries. And so from all of that, we sort of created this guy who doesn't want to be doing something that he thinks is is frivolous or for women or for, you know, a certain type of woman. And then, of course, Russ Marash is really like the father of DIY programming. Like after The French Chef, he did This Old House and Victory Garden. And
wow,
he's like the Ryan Murphy of health shows. I mean, and again, hopefully we'll have time to tell that story and we'll get to, you know, The French Chef aired for 11 seasons. So we'll get to show like that evolution of Russ. So we wanted to start him somewhere. We don't know if specifically he was trying to make, you know, civil rights documentaries, but it's
right. Okay.
But that felt true to what we had found.
But it's also there with Judith Jones too, right? With Blanche Knopf telling her that she should be more literary than.
Yeah. And again, that all just came from the research we did about Blanche. And also, you know, just that Judith literally like rescued the Diary of Anne Frank from the reject pile and was like, translate or was editing translations of Camus and Sartre and was John Updike's editor, and then Mastering the Art of French Cooking came her way, and she decided, and that was the only cookbook she was editing. What's fascinating about Judith Jones is she became like the definitive editor of cookbooks when we get into the 70s, you know, Mata Joffrey and Lydia Bastianich and James Beard eventually, and but mm-hmm. some like really, Marcella Hazan and all these sort of food icons and not just French or European food, like a global cuisine she was interested in. And she brought all of that to Knopf. So again, our hope is that we get to tell this story for more than this one season and we'll get.
Oh, you will. And I mean, it feels like such a beloved show already. So, I mean, maybe I'm biased because I just love it so much. But so I'm curious, like for you, just to tell the audience that's listening about you a little bit. I mean, you mentioned that you were a foodie, but like, did you grow up in a family with lots of cooking? Like, did your parents cook Julia Child recipes?
I did. My mother is a wonderful cook. And when I was a kid, she wrote a cookbook. And
really?
Yeah. And we grew, and my mother had the Julia books and did cook from them. We didn't watch The French Chef. My parents weren't big TV watchers. So I knew Julia more from the books. And then I knew about Julia because of Dan Aykroyd on Saturday Night Live. And I used to be like, I used to love staying up and watching David Letterman. And she had a hilarious kind of flirtatious, crazy. She did multiple David Letterman appearances that I loved.
Really? I didn't know that. I'm going to go on YouTube after this and look that up.
The episode, like the Crepe Suzette episode, that sort of inspired like her with the, by some of her like ear talk show.
Oh, that's funny.
There's one where she makes, where she's trying to make hamburgers with David Letterman and then the hot plate doesn't work. So she decides to make steak tartare instead.
That's really funny.
It's really funny. So that's how I knew. But yes, I grew up with wonderful food. I grew up going to, you know, my parents loved going out to eat. They loved taking.
Where were you? Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Toronto.
Oh, okay. Nice.
So that was always
good
cooking.
Food.
Yeah, good food. And we go to New York once a year. And so I grew up with, I'm picky. So I'm a foodie who's also very picky.
What are you picky about? What don't you eat?
I don't like eggs. So like everyone, I'm making omelets. And I'm like, oh, like even when we made the pilot and they had to like 20 omelets in a row. And I was like, oh, like, yeah.
I love that the creator of the Julia Child show hates eggs. That's really funny. I've actually heard that before. I have a friend, Stacey, who went to NYU, who doesn't just not like them. She gets like nauseated if she smells eggs cooking. And I kind of get that. Like there is something kind of like snotty and gross about just eggs. And so I respect that.
I like chocolate souffle and I like, you know, I eat things with eggs in them, but like a hard boiled egg is disgusting to me.
Wait, so to pivot, we're going to go back to your life and biography, but I want to pivot back to the show for a second because I forgot to ask you about the food and like the making of the food in the show and how that all happens. And who does it? And
it happened. First of all, Sarah is an amazing cook and she did not want like a double. So she did almost all of the cooking. Like in that first breakfast scene where she makes David an omelet, that's Sarah and cracking the eggs. Like that's all Sarah. So Sarah was incredible with the cooking. I mean, she just has an incredible work ethic. Like the part is huge. She has, you know, and she's, especially in the early episodes, she's in almost every scene and she was letter perfect. And she found this incredible voice that sort of honored Julia, but wasn't an imitation of Julia. And then she did all the cooking, all the chopping, everything.
Really?
Then we also have this incredible food stylist, Christine Toman, who, you know, so like whatever in the Queen of Sheba cake, you know, she would have to make like 15 Queen of Sheba cakes. Cause once you sliced through the cake once in a take, then you needed a new cake for the next take. So we had like,
right.
So it's, and she really wanted, even if there were sort of newer recipes that were more, I don't know, that were more foolproof or looked more beautiful, she really wanted to only cook authentic Julia recipes. So I think the only recipe that in the end we didn't use the authentic Julia recipe is the chocolate souffle in episode 8. And we all loved and ate the Julia chocolate souffle, but it didn't stay risen long enough.
right. So, I needed some souffle Viagra. Right.
So if you did like a Japanese cheesecake souffle, they stay hot.
Interesting. Okay. So that's the magic of television.
So that was the magic of television. But that's the only, and again, they tried, but we would try shooting it and just within a minute, it would start to fall a little bit. And we just needed it to stay. I mean, again, they made like 30 of them. And then, you know, so our craft service table would have like LaCroix water and like, you know, peanuts and chocolate souffle.
So were people in heaven?
Great Suzette. I mean, it was amazing. So everyone got to eat all the, you know, roast duck a l'orange. I mean, get all of this stuff in our, so it was really fun. It was really fun.
I love
that. Wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah. It feels like I interviewed one of the actors on the show Better Things, Pam Adlon's show.
Yeah, that show.
And on that show, she's always cooking. And I was like, is that, you know, are you guys really eating? They're like, yeah, it's like we're in somebody's kitchen. But with the Julia show, I mean, when she's like sauteing garlic and stuff, I mean, are you guys really smelling all that on the set? Like,
yeah.
Is it really, I mean, and then perfuming the air?
They were both like, Sarah talks about like in the pilot when she goes to the oyster house. And I mean, because we did so many takes, I forget what she says, but I think they each ate like 20 oysters. They each ate like 10 lobster tails. Like, it was crazy. David talks about like in the Joyce Chen Chinese restaurant that I think he ate something like 40 dumplings. There's one scene that actually didn't even make it into the show where she makes a pear clafoutis. She references it, but we don't. There was a scene where you saw it, and she kind of feeds him, and we. Mm-hmm. I think he ate the entire pear clafoutis, and then it's not even in the show.
Oh, that's so funny! I'm working with a friend who's a Broadway actor on a Broadway cookbook that's coming out in the fall. And they're all puns on Broadway shows, but our Beauty and the Beast is Clafouti and the Beast, and it has Julia's recipe in it. So I've made that many times. Yeah. So in terms of you said your mom wrote a cookbook, but when you say that, like, was it a book that for the family or did she publish?
No, it was a published cookbook in Canada called The Good Table.
Wow.
Yeah.
So
yeah, no, so yeah. She's an amazing cook.
Is she still around?
She's still around. Yeah.
So is she loving the show?
She is loving the show. Yeah. It's very nice. I'm both my parents are around, so I feel very lucky, and I'm just that they got to see me get to this moment is really nice.
And did you shoot the show in Boston? Is that
we shot the show in Boston. Even when we go to New York or San Francisco, we shot it all in Boston.
Yeah, because I noticed because my partner's shooting a movie there right now, and we were walking through Boston Common. And then when I watched the show, I was like, oh, that really is Boston Common. Yeah. It's not a joke.
Yeah. That was awesome. In the pilot, you see us actually on Mass Ave in Cambridge. Mm-hmm. And then we shot in Boston Common a couple times. So, and then, you know, the San Francisco, like we use the Fairmont Hotel.
Right.
The Fairmont Hotel in San Francisco and the Waldorf, you know, we use their ballroom to be the Waldorf ballroom. And
so to go back to the question of the like truth versus like taking liberties, like is when you're dealing with like a public figure like a Julia Child who has like a foundation or like you know, like an estate, like do you have to run things past them when you're doing a show like this,
so
or can you just go for it?
They were incredibly supportive and helpful and generous with us. They are they're consultants on the show, the Julia Child Foundation, and they read all the scripts as they were coming in, and they basically felt it was all true to the spirit of Julia.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, do we know if Julia had a run-in with Betty Friedan? No. Do we know if Julia sang "It Had to Be You" with Coco Van? No.
Right.
But they felt like everything we were doing felt true to the character and true to the biography, and we had their support. I think they knew that our heart was in the right place and that we had done all our research and then crafted these stories based on the research. And I know that's not always the case with the States. So we were very lucky to have them on our side. And then we also had the Smithsonian as a consultant, and they, you know, we recreated the kitchen exactly.
I noticed that. Yeah. Cause I've gone to the Smithsonian and seen that kitchen with the pegboard and all that
stuff.
It's amazing.
All designed to accommodate her height. And so, you know, we had a lot of experts on hand when we needed them, but they mostly were really helpful and really supportive. There's nothing we did in the first season that they took issue with. There's nothing we had to change or adjust. They just basically supported it, or they'd give us like a little detail about, I don't know, but like how she would squeeze her origins or something.
Right. Well, I think you captured something about her that I've read about, but that I hadn't seen in depictions of her or watching her show, which is her irreverence, and that she's kind of like, you know, she curses, she was horny, basically. I mean, there's these sides of her that you're seeing on this show that the people who are aware of her wouldn't necessarily know about.
Yeah, so that's in the books. Like, that's all in the research.
Yeah.
And then we also went to GBH and interviewed people that worked on the show. And so we, you know, sometimes we did, I mean, I interviewed the GBH people after I had written the pilot, and there were a few investments I made, but just a few. And then it was great information moving forward. Because again, in the pilot, she's not really at GBH yet. So
got it. And then in terms of like the other characters like Avis and Paul, but also like Alice at the network and Russ, like, did you feel you had to really research their real biographies to service their characters?
I mean, it was like, so in terms of Avis and Paul, the research that exists is really connected to Julia. It's hard to find too much about Avis that's not about Julia. It's hard to find too much about Paul that's not about Julia. There is stuff about Paul, and Paul's identical twin brother wrote a book, and we did a bunch of research, but we also didn't want to do so much research on the supporting characters that we wouldn't be able to craft a story. There's a lot out there about Judith, and we read Judith wrote an autobiography and there's just, you know, and when she passed away, there are some amazing obituaries of her that we read and used to draw from. Alice is the only character that's a composite character. So she's based on a few different people, but she's a made up character. So we did research in terms of people of color in public television, both at GBH and at WNET. And we did a little bit of research at, you know, based on Ruth Lockwood, who was actually the woman who booked her and I'd been reading and was the associate producer.
Got it.
The French Chef, but Ruth was Julia's roommate at Smith, and we liked the idea of broadening the scope of the show and having a younger character on the show. And it, again, it felt all true to the research. Nothing we did didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
So, but Alice is the only character. I guess Hunter is also a composite character. He wasn't in the pilot, but he's based on Hartford Gunn, who was the head of GBH at the time, but also some other public television executives that we did research on.
Well, what's interesting, I mean, in terms of like how you tell the story, I mean, this is obvious because I think this will be obvious to anyone watching, but it's like the thematics of each episode, like the one that I just watched, the most recent that's up on HBO is the foie gras episode. And, you know, and it's not like it clobbers you over the head, but it's like that episode really seemed to be about being a woman in that time period and what it meant for different women in different positions. Because you have Betty Friedan confronting Julia at the gala, but you also have Judith Jones getting yelled at by Blanche Knopf about not being ambitious enough. And then you also have Alice going to the diner on her date and saying she doesn't want to have children. So, I mean, how... when you come up with these themes for these episodes, does it sort of happen organically, or was that something you laid out in advance?
A little bit of both. I mean, we always knew, even when because I did a ton of research, and then I sat with Chris when we were sort of like crafting the pitch. And even when we were pitching it to the networks, we always knew there was going to be a San Francisco episode where Julia gets on stage with a drag performer dressed as Julia. Like we always knew she was going to go to her Smith College reunion and meet someone who was in love with her when they were in college. We always knew she was going to go to this gala and meet Betty Friedan, who was going to... And by the way, like, we wanted Betty Friedan's argument to be a valid argument and a real argument and a good argument. And what we were hoping... I mean, the sort of episode 7, in the writer's room, we talked a lot about like Hello Dolly and Into the Woods. And in Hello Dolly, everyone goes to New York City and they're all sort of separated and they all run around and go on their various adventures. And then they all meet up at the end at the restaurant.
Uh-huh.
And then in Into the Woods, everyone goes into the woods and then goes to the ball. But everyone's expectations have been upended. So Julia goes to New York thinking it's going to be a magical, wonderful weekend. And it's really the first time in the show where not only does Betty Friedan, you know, give her a talk down, but Blanche does at Lutèce, and then Andre Soltner does also at Lutèce. So it's just a challenging day for her. While Alice thinks like, ugh, my mother is setting me up with someone. This is going to be a disaster. And it flips. It turns out to be something special.
Got
it. Russ thinks he's going to meet this documentary filmmaker and she's going to say, you go. And she sort of surprises him. So everyone's expectation, and, you know, and Avis is good. Avis and Paul come together. And we really wanted to have everyone go thinking one thing would happen and then the opposite thing would happen. And that's sort of how we built the themes of that episode.
That's really interesting. So it's almost like the design, or like the good like practices of storytelling, are first and foremost in terms of like what will be a good entertaining piece of television where we surprise the audience and take them places we didn't see where they're going, and then sort of like a puzzle, then it's sort of like fitting it into the themes and the characters. And
then also this is the, you know, this is the second last episode of the season, so we wanted Julia to really be in crisis as we go into the finale and has something that she has to sort through and figure out, you know, and sort of resolve in the next episode.
And so are you in a writer's room right now for season two, or is that
we
not...
are in a writer's room now for season two, although we haven't been officially given a season two order yet. But we've been working now for almost 2 months on the second season. So we're, you know, we're hoping.
Well, I'm hoping too. But in terms of like pacing, like it feels like the story, you know, it takes its time in places in ways that make it more pleasurable, because it's sort of like you get to, you know, really sit in the story. But I imagine when you're doing a show like this, you're probably thinking to yourself, well, how quickly do I want to get through this?
It's really interesting. When we pitched the show, we thought the first season would end with her being nominated for the first educational television Emmy, which was, so we thought the first season was going to cover 3 years, just sort of like The Crown that you cover, because again, in terms of the biography, in terms of the events, there just aren't that many events. So we thought we were going to cover a bigger period of time. When we got into the writer's room, we realized the like how they invented food television and all those beats were really fun and really interesting. And we slowed the story down. So unlike, you know, Julia and Julia, which covers 15 years of her life in 1 hour, we cover 1 year of her life in 8 hours. So we got to tell intimate stories, and we got to show the private Julia and see what she's like when she's by herself, or see what she's like alone, you know, with her husband behind closed doors, or at the doctor's office. So we got to sort of explore the interior moments of Julia. And I think hopefully, and Sarah's so brilliant, and really flesh her out, as opposed to like a more traditional biopic where you just hit the great hit events. We didn't have to do that. It's so funny because in drama school at NYU, you're always taught to like start as close to the end as possible and get through. And what I learned on Mrs. Maisel and now through Julia is that's just not true.
What a waste of an MFA.
At least in a comedy, but there is something to be said for slowing a story down and getting emotionally invested in characters and seeing them grow over time and evolve over time, as opposed to skipping important beats on the journey. So we slowed this, you know, originally, again, I thought the pilot was going to take us through making the pilot. And then when I started writing it, I realized there was no way to do that and have you actually learn anything about the characters. So we split it into two episodes. So the pilot of Julia was actually only the first half of the outline I wrote for the pilot. And then the second episode was
the second
half of the outline.
There's something very meta about the making of a show about Julia making a show too, because it's sort of like,
oh, and it's a first season about a first season.
Yeah. And you guys are doing all the things that she did in a way.
And I obsessed, you know, again, because of COVID and because of all these other hiccups that we had, I spent like 2.5 years working on the pilot And then all of a sudden we got a sort of early pickup, and then we had like 10 weeks to write 7 more Davis phones.
Oh like, my God.
And just like That's what Julia crazy. Goes through, like it's one thing to make a pilot, and then Russ is like, okay, I need 26 episodes, you know? So it really was, there was something very meta about it.
And then in terms of the production of these episodes, I mean, even just the one I just watched, the gala, I mean, it's like, there's so much that goes into these. I mean, they're beautiful. So was that part of the process for you in terms of like being a writer now? I mean, I guess Mrs. Maisel maybe set you up to like learn all about that kind of production
stuff.
Well,
it's interesting,
but
you know, the pilot actually is really a lot of two character scenes with people eating.
Basically. Yeah, right.
And Charles McDougall, who directed the pilot, he really gave the show its scale. So I remember it was like our second day of shooting, and it was outside Savinor's where she bumps into her friend with the baby carriage. And I wrote, it's a two character scene. It's one page. I thought we would shoot it in front of the window. We'd see the butcher. It would be, you know, like a close shot. And I got to the street, and the street was closed, and there were police there, and there were 50 period cars and 100 extras. And I was like, what is going on? But
it
gave the show size and scope and made it feel bigger. And I'm so grateful to him for that. And he did that everywhere. Like when I've been reading, it never occurred to me that there were that many people on the crew on the other side, and that, or the bullpen at GBH when she walks down the hall and sees it all. And probably it's bigger than the actual GBH was at the time, but I think it gave the show a kind of scale and a kind of size. And then the other directors, and then that became, you know, that became the aesthetic of the show, and all the other directors that came on afterwards, they all brought their own artistry and their own voice to it, but they had to honor the template that Charles had created. And I'm really grateful.
Oh, yeah. The period details, even like in terms of like that gala event, where was that Rich Little? Was that supposed to be Rich Little doing
Von
JFK?
Meter. It was
Von Meter.
Yeah. But also again, and then doing it all in COVID. So like all of, especially the pilot before the vaccines, it was like the Truman Show or something, because they're in these beautiful, colorful period clothes and these beautiful color period sets. And we're wearing masks and shields and gloves. And there's like tape and lines of like zones where you, I mean, it was sort of, so it is amazing when I think we made the whole show during COVID and we had those scenes and those extras, and you don't feel it at all. I don't think you don't feel the,
no, yeah. I would never have known that. So as a final question for this part of the podcast, was there anything that you learned like making this show in terms of food, or did it affect you in terms of how you approach cooking and eating at home or eating out? Or,
well, I'm just trying to be, you know, I told you I was picky, so I'm trying to be a little less picky. So like last night we went out with friends to like the Momofuku noodle bar in the Time Warner Center, and the special was sweetbreads, and they had just watched the episode.
Yeah,
like we have to get them, and I'm like, I've never had sweet
ones. What? Really? You never even had them when they did it on the episode?
And they were like, Daniel, you have. And I even said that Christine actually made sweetbreads for some people in the cast because they wanted to taste them because they'd never had them. And even though we never see them cooked on the show, she made them for them. And I was like a little squeamish, and so I had sweetbreads last night. So I and they were delicious.
There you go.
And
there you go.
And then like for our anniversary, we went to a fancy restaurant, and there's some stuff that I'm a little like, you know, I was a little nervous to eat, but it was a prefix menu. And I was about to say, can you adjust this for me? And can you adjust this for me? And my wife was like, Daniel, you have a Julia Child show coming out in 2 months. Just like, go for it. So I'm trying to be more adventurous.
I love that. That's hilarious. I mean, well, that's perfect. It sounds like you're actually this is like her ghost is like smiling down on you right now.
Thank you. That's nice.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for doing the first part of my interview. We're going to take a quick, like, 2-second pause, and then I'll just start asking you some fun questions. So thanks again.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for listening to this very special Julia Child episode of the Amateur Gourmet Podcast. I forgot to mention that I have a brand new episode of my YouTube show up this week. This week, I show you how to make brunch. I make scrambled eggs with Gruyere and caramelized onions, which I think Julia Child would approve of. I also make Smitten Kitchen's blueberry muffins and crispy bacon that I bake in the oven. If you want to watch that, just go onto YouTube and search The Amateur Gourmet Show, and be sure to like and subscribe. All right, well, if you want to hear my bonus episode with Daniel Goldfarb, be sure to subscribe to my Substack, which is amateurgourmet.substack.com. amateurgourmetpodcast.com, and you'll get to hear the 10 bonus questions tomorrow. All right. Well, I'll see you back here next week. To quote Julia, bon appetit.